All right, good evening, everybody, and thank you for coming to the candidate forum for the 10th Congressional District. We are very pleased we have all four candidates for the 10th Congressional District here, present and accounted for. We have Mr. Jeremy Peruski, Mr. Harley Mickelson, Ms. Kimberly Bison, and Congressman Paul Mitchell. I'd first like to thank, before we get started, Thelma Castillo, from the Blue Water Chamber. This event is co-hosted by the City of Marysville and the Blue Water Chamber. So we would like to thank Thelma for all of her support in getting this candidate forum ready and accounted for. I would also like to recognize some dignitaries in the room. That would be Marysville City Council members Paul Wessel and Greg Badley. We have the chair of the St. Clair County Commission, Jeff Bohm. We have St. Clair County Commissioner Duke Dunn. Mayor Eileen Tesh from the City of Elginac. Fort Gratiot Township Supervisor Georgia Baldwin. State Representative Shane Hernandez. We've got 81st District House candidate Gary Eisen, Port Huron City Council candidate Jeff Pemberton. We've got Don Brown, Macomb County Board of Commissioners, Dr. Annette Mercantant from the St. Clair County Health Department, and Carrie Heptine from the St. Clair County Executive. The format will be as follows. Each candidate has been assigned a number randomly through the drawing of cards, ace, one, two, three, and four. Mr. Peruski has drawn the ace, Mr. Mickelson the two, Ms. Bison the three, and of course, Congressman Mitchell the four. That is their going to be their assigned number. Each candidate will be given 1 minute to do an opening in random order. If I draw the four first, for instance, Congressman Mitchell will go first, and then I draw the second card, and so on, so on and so forth. And that will be the format all the way through the questions. I would like to thank the AP Government class from Marysville High School. Members of that class are Robert Hunt, TJ Giles, Gage Green, Emily LaFrance, Matthew Bacon, Brianna Booth, Noah Green, and Caitlin Dean, as well as their teacher, Mrs. Christine Shigley, for assisting the city in drafting all of the questions for tonight's event. So, without further ado, we will get started with an opening statement. Each candidate will have 1 minute for an opening statement. We will start with candidate number one, Mr. Peruski.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jeremy Peruski. I'm not a Republican, and I'm not a Democrat. First independent over 50 years on the ballot here in our district. And basically, I care about the community. First and foremost, it's not the parties. I could care less about the parties. I care mostly about us and our community and everybody here. I was born and raised on a dairy farm up north in by Deckerville, if anybody knows where that's at. Spent the second half of my life advising some of the largest technology companies in the world on how to be able to grow their businesses. And so in the process of doing this, I did that up until about a couple of years ago when my father passed away. When he passed away, it was one of those chances where I just wanted to come back and be closer to family, so I moved back. But when I came back, I found the community has been torn up. It's basically been very divided, and it's primarily because of politics. And when you look at this, and you look at the politics and the divisiveness that we see right now, it's driven by the politicians. The politicians feel that they're more accountable to specific party talking points versus actually addressing what we, the community, needs. They're more concerned about listening to the special interests versus actually being able to address the issues that we have and come up with common sense solutions for the 80% to move us forward. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peruski. Candidate number three, Kimberly Bison.
First of all, can you hear me now?
Can hear you now.
First of all, thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself. My name is Kimberly Bison. A little bit about me. I'm a farm girl, an entrepreneur, a businesswoman. I'm also a community leader in Lexington, Michigan, and have been for 14 years. I also am a climate reality leader. People ask me, why am I running in this race? I'm running to be here for you. I think one of the things that we can agree on is a good representative needs to listen to people. I'm also here to support our public schools. They are in need of the resources that they need in order in order to educate our youth. I am also here to make sure that we fight for your Social Security and your pensions. I am also here for our environment, to be able to protect our Great Lakes and to provide a future for your children and your grandchildren. And finally, I'm here for you. Thank you.
Thank you. And last but certainly not least, Congressman Mitchell.
Thank you. Let me thank you, Mayor Damon, and the Chamber for sponsoring this event. Thanks very much. I'm the oldest son of seven. My dad was an auto worker. My mom worked at Salvation Army. I worked 30 years in the private sector and decided, frankly, that government was going the wrong direction. The things we worked for our children and grandchildren were becoming harder and harder to achieve. I decided I need to run on specific promises, not talking points, not politics, to talk about specific things I would work on if I were elected to Congress. Cutting taxes and regulation, getting the economy growing, protecting our Great Lakes. We'll go through a list. Hopefully we'll talk about those things today. But more importantly, we've accomplished many of those things, and we're working on the others. Because politics shouldn't be talking points. They also shouldn't be just divide and conquer. And what most people don't know, in the first 21 months in Congress, 70% of the laws that have been passed and signed into law are bipartisan. They're Republican and Democrat laws. They're not a divided Congress, as would lead you to believe some of the concepts of people running, is that it's all a battle. It's not. So thanks very much. I look forward to conversations.
Thank you, Congressman Mitchell. So before we get started, a couple of things. Number one, I would just again ask the audience to please turn off your cell phone. I think that it would be very distracting, not only for the candidates, but for the other people here that are hoping to glean something about our candidates from this forum. Candidates, in the event, for some reason, if your microphone starts going a little, I'm going to call it wonky, and that is a technical term, it is because your cell phone is too close to the microphone, okay? So just bear that in mind. The rules of this are very, very simple. I will ask a question. Each candidate will have 2 minutes to answer the question. The responses will again be in random order. I do not wish to cut anybody off, but to be fair to all candidates, if you exceed your two-minute time limit, I will be forced to. I will take no pleasure in it. I will not have a smile on my face, but I will be forced to do it nonetheless. I hope you can all understand. All right. We are now ready to proceed. Question one. According to recent polls in the Wall Street Journal and NBC News, health care is the number one issue for voters in this midterm election, with the cost of prescription drugs and single-payer coverage being the most concerning matters within health care, according to a poll by Forbes. Please explain first what you believe to be the problems that plague our health care system, and then please explain what resolutions you have to help cure those problems. I understand that I've limited you to 2 minutes and we could spend 2 days. However, I would invite Mr. Perusky to please go first.
Okay, thank you. In terms of looking at some of the biggest issues that we have right now, being an independent, I look at things from a very practical perspective. What are things, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, that we can address? And when we're looking at the problems I have here, one, I know my mom, who's in the audience here, we talk about pharmaceutical prices, how crazy the prices are, how she has to go from Walmart to Kmart to Rite Aid trying to compare where she's going to get cheaper drugs. This is ridiculous. If you look at every single developed country around this world, they put caps on all the pharmaceuticals in terms of what they charge, so they can't keep escalating prices. You see EpiPens, the prices have been going up 300-400% over the last 4 or 5 years. It's been around since 1922, so people can't say that, oh, well, you know, there's a shortage or whatever the issue may be, whatever argument they want to make. We need to be able to control these costs, because if there's not cost controls on this, then we get in a situation where you're seeing this price escalation and nobody's taking responsibility. And you look at a very simple fact is with Medicare. Medicare is legally not allowed to negotiate drug prices. Can you imagine that the largest drug buyer in the world can't negotiate prices? It makes absolutely zero sense. I'm a finance guy, so I've been in finance for over 20 years. It makes zero sense. It's like telling Walmart you can't negotiate when you're buying, you know, a billion gadgets. And so from my perspective, in terms of resolutions, two very simple ones. Again, I just look at what's the low-hanging fruit that the vast majority of us can agree upon. Caps on pharmaceutical prices, and then also making sure that there's separation between the doctors and hospitals and prescriptions and for pharmaceuticals and for services, because we know we have a lot of examples, and my dad was one of these examples when he had cancer. It is the doctors are being paid because they're prescribing drugs, they're prescribing services and stuff that may or may not really necessarily be needed, but they're making more money off of it. So from my perspective, those would be two ways that I would handle that.
Thank you, Mr. Perusky. Congressman Mitchell.
Thanks very much. I think when you look at health care, you have to look at the history as you deal with the problem. The Affordable Care Act was sold to us that we could keep, if you liked your health care, you could keep it. If you liked your doctor, you could keep it. And you would save $2,500 annually on your premiums. We now know that none of those things were true. The current conversation is we'll create another version of a national program to fix health care. They messed it up once. Now they're concerned about people with pre-existing conditions. The positions I've taken on it are pretty clear. I voted multiple times to protect pre-existing conditions. Put $8 billion into what didn't pass, frankly, the Affordable Care Act, the American Health Care Act, to protect people with pre-existing conditions, give states flexibility to decide how to cover those folks in communities. Since that failed in the Senate by one vote, what we've done is significant. It has reduced the rate of increase in premiums considerably. We're now at the lowest rate of increase in premiums in 5 years. How's that happen? Allowing association health plans, groups to gather together, like Farm Bureau and others, to create health plans, to allow groups that allow options in terms of flexibility of premiums or programs that are offered rather than the one-size-fits-all requirements that were the Affordable Care Act. So there's a broader range of coverages you can buy now than there were before. To eliminate the individual mandate on people that were forced to buy health care or health insurance, which didn't necessarily guarantee health care, but they had to buy this insurance or face a tax penalty. What's left to do? We have to empower generic drug makers to be able to make generic drugs. They're prevented from doing that by the biopharmacy people. We have to have transparency of costs of all health care, from what it costs to get an MRI at one facility versus another, so people can make a wise decision because they are paying for that health care, either through their premiums and their taxes. So let's let them know what they're buying before, in fact, they're suddenly stuck with a bill. That's my approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman Mitchell. Mr. Mickelson.
I have a plan for health care. It's to expand Medicaid and Medicare to cover everybody. We need a government-financed medical care system. I'm opposed to what Mr. Mitchell is proposing, and what we really need the government to be negotiating with the doctors, the hospitals, and the drug companies for us. A single payer negotiating for us, for our benefit. Healthcare should be a human right. It shouldn't be something that people do to make a fortune, which is what's happening in this country. Our insurance companies and our drug companies are making a fortune. You can drive along 75 and you can drive through any of our big cities and you look at the names on top of those big buildings. They're medical names. They're insurance companies. They are the ones that are making all the money. We need to reduce the price of the bureaucracy. The government bureaucracy for Medicare is much more efficient than the private industry is. I mean, the private industry takes about 20% off the top, where the government would only take like 2 or 3%. No government employee is going to be making $1.2 million to head an insurance company. And government employees work hard. I was a government employee all my life. I push paper. I can push paper for a lot less than $1.2 million. I also cared for people. And that's why we need to put the government into healthcare. Healthcare is for people's benefit. It's not to make money on. We need to really think about that. Do we really want to make a fortune off our sickest people? I don't think so. And if we, a government-run system will drastically reduce the cost of healthcare.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mickelson. Ms. Bison.
Well, you're absolutely correct on healthcare being the number one issue. I've been on the campaign trail for over 13 months, and it is something that I've heard over and over again. I believe it's a human right to have access to affordable, quality healthcare. For some people, it's a matter of life and death. I have a lady from Port Sinlac who calls me every 2 weeks. Her daughter has a heart transplant, and she asked me how the campaign is going, and she's making sure that that things are on target, because she's worried and she's in economic difficulties and she's scared to be thrown off of Affordable Care Act. So with that being said, I couldn't agree with you more. So one of the things that I would propose is not to eliminate ACA, especially not with the plan put in place for those people with the pre-existing conditions. 11 million people would get thrown off of health care. And recently, in that last tax proposal in past, 40,000 people would have lost their ACA health care here in District 10. So this is a huge problem. So we need to come in and we need to fix what's wrong with the Affordable Care Act. There's probably about 3 or 4 things identified to do right away. That has to be done immediately before throwing people off of health care. I also am a little bit more of a progressive Democrat in that I would like to find solutions where we can find a sense of either universal or single-payer systems. It can help with car insurance, and it can help small business owners, you know, in making more profit where they don't have to burden themselves with the health care of their employees. So I think there's a lot of benefits to trying to come together in a bipartisan format and review solutions that are actually working for people. The second part of this that I would attack is really the high price of prescription drugs. As Jeremy mentioned, it's really out of control. So the big pharmacies need to be accountable for their price, and prices need to be moderated, definitely for the people, because they quite simply have to choose between a house payment and an EpiPen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bison. Next question, we'll talk taxes for a moment. The Treasury Department reported this week that individual income tax collections for fiscal year 2018 totaled $1.7 trillion. That's up $14 billion from fiscal year 2017 and at an all-time high. And that's despite the fact that individual income tax rates got a significant cut this year as part of President Donald Trump's tax reform plan. The Treasury also reported that the 2018 deficit swelled to $779 billion. That is the highest level in 6 years, and it marks a 17% increase over 2017. Federal spending as a share of the economy fell, but revenue fell even more, with corporate tax receipts plummeting 31%. The Congressional Budget Office forecasts deficits hitting $981 billion in 2019 and exceeding $1 trillion every year after that. Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, envisions growth ending up at 2.9% for 2018, 2.8% for 2019, and 0.9% for 2020. If you were to believe these statistics, what grade would you give President Trump's tax reform, and would you support the next tax break he spoke of earlier this week? Congressman Mitchell.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I think it's appropriate you started here because I campaigned on the need for tax reform and tax cuts. Tax code was 74,000 pages long. You had to be a wizard to understand it. We taxed small businesses, LLCs, people that had small business twice, their business, and then they paid a personal tax on top of that. It was punitive. I campaigned for it because it cut taxes in our district for individual filers by $2,700 over the previous year. And as you note, tax returns this year are, in fact, up to the same levels they were during the last year of the Obama administration. We don't have a tax problem. We have a spending problem. We've had a spending problem for a long time. The reality is we've got something called discretionary spending and mandatory spending. Mandatory spending includes such things as feeding the Mustangs on Chincoteague Island. That's a mandatory item. Funding our military or homeland security, that's a discretionary spending item. Think about that for a moment. We have to debate and argue whether we fund our homeland security or we fund our military, but the Mustangs. I like horses. I live in an area that has horses. But seriously, I proposed a bill called the Protect Our Children's Future Act to revamp our budgeting and appropriations process, to go to a 2-year budget process, not unlike Michigan's done, to require zero-based budgeting from all government agencies every couple of years, rotate them all through. Because here's the thing with the government. They ask for a 5% increase, they get a 3% increase, and they tell you they get a budget cut. Now, in the real world, in the private sector, you take a budget cut, you spend less real money. You don't say you got less than you asked for. That's like a teenager. That proposal of mine protects Medicare, TRICARE and Social Security. It puts them as mandatory items. Let me be clear about that, because there's been some confusion about why you're cutting Medicare. No one's cutting Medicare. No one's cutting Social Security. All the other programs, those have to be voted on. They have to be analyzed, zero-based budgeting, because we're spending too much in almost every area of government, and for the most part, it's on bureaucrats sitting in cubicles in Washington. That's my plan, and I'm going to work on it.
Thank you, Congressman Mitchell. Kim Bison.
I would give President Trump a D as far as his tax reform, I'm sorry to say. I think that it was really a slap in the face when he went ahead and gave the top 1% the largest tax cut. That was just we need a fair playing field when we talk about taxing for the rich and in the middle class. I do understand that he did give a small tax break for the middle class. That's great. But then when we have tariffs and things like that and our products go up, it doesn't seem like it's really matching out too much. So the other thing that I have to say about the tax reform is that Mr. Mitchell mentions spending. Well, I think that we really need to take a look at that budget and really pull out that pork fat and see what is working and what isn't working. But at no time do we need to take away programs that are working for people. It seems like this last year, everything is under attack underneath that budget, that are programs that are working for people. So with that being said, that's the grade that I would give him. And I think moving forward, we need to come together in a bipartisan format and figure out how to balance the budget. I don't think that this last year held very much fiscal responsibility for those that are in power. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bison. Jeremy Peruski.
So I love this question. This is one of the biggest reasons. This is the main reason why I ran, because basically I actually voted for Paul. And so when we look at it, I voted because he had a strong business background and everything like that. And kind of like my letter that I sent to or that I hand delivered to them, the invitation to debate, the discussion was about the fact that when we look at the budget, right now, there is nobody that is driving this fiscal bus in America. Whether we're talking about the tax cut or whether we're talking about the budget, it was one of the largest budget increases of all time. And so there's nobody that's in charge. Nobody cares. There's zero fiscal responsibility. Whether you're Democrats or Republicans, nobody has any sort of credibility when it comes to being fiscally responsible. And for all of us and for our kids and everybody else and like our posterity, should be worried about this. $21 trillion right now. It's going up. We got $1 trillion in deficit that we're going to have next year. And Paul talks about we have a spending problem. Yeah, we have a really big spending problem. There's absolutely no question about that. I think everybody knows that. And we see, and we have to start thinking about common sense areas where we can cut. But when you look at situations like when we had this budget, like some of the stuff that I was looking at, the DOD had requested $600 billion. The Department of Defense. So you imagine when you go into a negotiation, you're always going to kind of aim high when you want to ask for your budgets. They came in, they asked for $600 billion. Well, we gave $640. So basically, we gave $40 billion more to the military, and military is like, what are we going to do with this money? And so this overallocation, all this money that we're seeing going out, there's a lot of fat that needs to be cut across the board. And there's a lot, we got to get our fiscal house in order, first and foremost. And so the tax cut, if I was grading it, I would give them a B minus, a C plus, because we need tax reform, but we need to simplify. We didn't need to double the number of loopholes that the corporations had. We need to simplify it for people so that individuals can have something a lot easier to be able to file. But then there are a lot of other issues with it. But again, the number one issue is we should be getting our fiscal house in order before we're giving money back.
Thank you, Mr. Peruski. Finally, Mr. Mickelson.
Well, I would give President Trump an F on his tax cuts. Why? Because in the long run, they're going to hurt you. What he has done is he's put more money into the economy. And we have not necessarily increased the amount of goods and services that are available. So in the long run, this tax cut is going to lead to inflation, and that tax cut is going to be eaten away by higher costs that you're going to be paying. What really needed to be done is to have people with money pay more in taxes to bring down that deficit. There's all kinds of things that need to be done, but we need to, there's all kinds of things that need to be done, and it takes money to do them. And in order to prevent inflation, you have to tax people. Taxes have become a dirty word to people. But you're not going to fix things without putting money into it, and taxes is how you get that money. Our government is spending money by not taxing people, which is causing inflation. They have built inflation into the system. And what I'm afraid of, we've been living with moderate inflation, which we can handle if it comes slowly. But this last tax cut, we won't see the effects of that for about 2 years. The figures that he gave you there about our gross national product going from 2.9% increase to 2.8 to 0.9, that's what's going to happen because of this tax cut, because they didn't raise the taxes on people who could actually afford to pay more. You don't want to give a millionaire a 2% tax increase. They'll just buy more goods and services, which will make costs everything go up for you. When they build their 8,000 square foot home, that increases the price of building materials for everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Mickelson. We appreciate your response. Question number three. We're going to talk about gun violence. Gun violence has taken center stage in the United States with mass shootings at Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Pulse Nightclub, Route 91 Harvest Concert in Las Vegas, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida, San Bernardino, and the list goes on. What is your view on balancing the rights ensured under the Second Amendment to responsible gun owners with the belief that the federal government has an obligation to regulate the sale, use, and possession of firearms? Please feel free to discuss universal background checks, bump stocks, and assault weapons in general. Ms. Bison, you're up first.
Thank you. As a Democrat, we often get labeled as taking away the Second Amendment, and that's not correct. As a Congresswoman, I would uphold the Constitution, so I'd like to be very clear about that. My father, my uncle, my cousins, they're all avid hunters, so we're familiar with the sportsmanship and the things that they'd like to do with their guns. So I get that. However, with these school shootings, we really need to take a look at what's going on. I happened last year to be part of that rally that was in Port Huron with the high school students. They had reached out to the representative in order to get some comment or to find out if Congress was going to act on a congressional hearing to find out if, in fact, there is something that we can do to keep our children safe. And that's what this is about, keeping our children safe. There are many things that we can take a look at. And I do support a congressional hearing to find out what those things are. And actually, I also think that the NRA needs to stay out of the lobby money, and when we're passing bills, they need to stay out of the hall room while those things are going on. But let me tell you what the students felt. The students are scared when it comes to lockdowns. I talked to a 10-year-old. He has a tornado drill 1 minute and a lockdown the next 2 weeks. This just isn't the norm. We could do universal background checks. If somebody wants to purchase an AR-15, I believe they deserve to be extra vetted. Now, I know there's some HIPAA clause and some things like that when it comes to the mental ill, and trying to go ahead and get that dialogue and to find out really what their background is. But if somebody has six, violent crimes on their record, we might want to vet that person a little bit more and say no to that person. So I think there is room on a bipartisan platform to have conversations and to come together. And I think the American people and our kids deserve that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bison. Mr. Perusky.
So I grew up on a dairy farm, as I mentioned earlier, up north here. So hunting's a pretty big part of our family and a lot of what we do. So I'm a huge Second Amendment supporter. There's no questions about that. But the one thing that I'll agree with Kim on is the fact that something has changed in our society over the last 10 years, where we're seeing a lot of this increase, as Dan was talking about, the increase in a lot of the school violence, the shootings. Something has changed. Whether it's our cell phones, whether it's violent TV or whatever the case may be, I don't know what the answer is. But we do know something has changed. We need to be able to do research and try and figure out what is going on here. The fact that we had laws on the books that prevented the CDC from doing research on gun-related deaths, I didn't understand it. Like, that seems kind of ridiculous. They said that they put it on the laws, on the books, because basically they said that every conclusion came that it was against guns. But Again, I don't understand the logic personally, and I'm just trying to look at it from a very common sense perspective, but we got to understand what's going on, what's changed in our society that is doing this. In terms of addressing some accessories, there's a way that I look at it, whether it's bump stock, silencers, this stuff shouldn't be legal. There's absolutely no hunters. The vast majority of people that I speak to, nobody wants this stuff or needs this stuff, and it's stuff that there's no reason to have it legalized or anything along those lines. It makes absolutely no sense. And what it does, it makes it so that that any of the violence that's done, people become more anonymous, and the death toll becomes significantly more. So it doesn't, from that perspective, it doesn't make sense. But that's for me.
Thank you. Mr. Perusky. Congressman Mitchell.
Thank you. There's a lot of ways that this is a personal issue to me. My oldest son's a police officer in Oakland County. And my middle son was supposed to be at that concert in Las Vegas, but he got to town late and didn't go. So I understand the concern. Congress has expanded background checks. The problem we've had is that many states haven't complied with submitting the information necessary for background checks, and it's not in the system. We need to get full compliance of the states to the current system before we just decide we're going to expand more, because it's not being done. It's being done better than it was, thankfully, but it's not being done. I oppose bump stocks. I said very early on I opposed them. In fact, the NRA, that's sometimes referred to and vilified, they banned them on their ranges. A good friend of mine in Congress, he's a Navy SEAL. They don't use them. Can't keep them accurate. So the reality is bump stocks are something that should be banned, and the ATF can do that. I believe they're looking at it, but I can't tell you that for sure at this point in time. I oppose them and certainly support doing so. We've taken specific action. I co-sponsored and voted for the Stop School Violence Act that put additional money and resources into schools so they could secure their facilities and keep our kids safe. I'm currently working on a bill that would expand funding for school resource officers to help schools and school districts fund school resource officers, because they're a deterrent. Teachers and administrators have told me that having a school resource officer there not only makes them feel safer, but stops the routine kind of bullying and violence that happens in a school. My oldest son was a school resource officer for a couple of years before he went off and became a detective. I think they're important. I think they can be an important component of school safety and support that. Let me take a second to correct a couple of things about taxes that my opponents don't quite have right. The tax bill did not force anybody off of health care. Second of which is, nor did it double the loopholes for corporations. And I'd be happy to go through that if they'd like to go through it in more detail sometime.
Thank you, Congressman Mitchell. Mr. Mickelson.
We need to get rid of guns that kill people, and we need to really take a look at our Constitution and what it really says. I mean, if you read the preamble, the job of a government is to promote the general welfare. It is no way in our welfare to have people going around killing people with these weapons that we have. Nobody is going to take away rifles and shotguns that people use for hunting, but there's no reason to have handguns and semi-automatic weapons that hold dozens of rounds. There's no reason for them. The reason for those are to fight wars and to protect people. I mean, police officers and soldiers need those weapons. We do not need those. We need judges that will interpret that Constitution like it was interpreted for most of our history, not to protect individual rights, but collective rights. We, the people, have the right to protect ourselves. We have a right to join a National Guard. We can join a police force. That's what we need to protect us, not individual guns. I mean, if somebody wants to have a shotgun in their home to protect their house, that's fine with me. But they don't need to be carrying around guns. They don't need to be carrying around handguns and semi-automatic weapons. That doesn't do anybody any good. We have more guns in this country than almost any other country, and we need to do something about that to reduce the number. We need gun buyback programs. Hunters, if they want guns, I don't even think rifles and shotguns, if they hold less than 5 rounds, should be licensed, or you'd need a permit to buy them or a background check. But handguns, semi-automatics, nobody needs them except soldiers and police officers.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mickelson.